So the first story took place a year ago, and Terence and Rupert were involved in no part of this story. I was sitting in my office with my secretary, Nina, about a year and a half ago. There was a knock on the door. She said, "Well, this is a friend of a friend of mine who wants to interview you." But I was very busy with the telephone and the correspondence and stuff. So he came and sat, and I answered his questions without thinking. Later on, a month or so passed, a photographer arrived, and I began to realize that I'd done something significant. I'd given an interview for GQ magazine. I called my children, who know about such things, and asked them what was GQ magazine, and they knew what it was and follow and read it to some extent. They live in Hollywood. I was in Italy when the magazine finally arrived on the stands. And of course, I had notified my children, my mother, and everybody. I was very proud that, in spite of my style of dress, that I had been the first one in our circle to actually be photographed for GQ. But I was shocked in Firenze to open the first page of the magazine and to see my picture occupying a large part of the first page, the table of contents page, where the heading says, "Abraham sells drugs to mathematicians." And there were some other insulting things in the interview that, as far as I could remember, was largely fiction that occurred later on in the magazine. So I didn't mention it to anybody. I came back to California, and I was very pleased that nobody mentioned it. Nobody had noticed. There were one or two phone calls, and I realized that nobody, after all, does read GQ. And if they do look at the pictures, they somehow overlooked mine. So I squeaked by, and I was safe after all this dangerous pass, being outed by GQ. Suddenly, my peace was disturbed once again by 100 phone calls in a single day asking what did I think of the article about me in the San Francisco Examiner or the Chronicle or the San Jose Mercury and so on. After all, the embers in the fire left by GQ had flamed up again in the pen of a journalist. A woman who writes a computer column for the San Francisco Examiner had received in her mailbox a copy of this article in GQ, in which Timothy Leary is quoted as saying, "The Japanese go to Burma for teak, and they go to California for novelty and creativity." And everybody knows that California has this resource thanks to psychedelics. And there again, it quoted me as the supplier of a scientific renaissance in the 1960s. And this columnist didn't believe what was asserted by Timothy Leary and others in the GQ article, that the computer revolution and the computer graphic innovations of California had been built upon a psychedelic foundation. So she set out to prove that this story was false. She was about to go to SIGGRAPH, the largest gathering of computer graphic professionals in the world. Annually, somewhere in the United States, 30,000 or so people gather, all of whom are vitally involved in the computer revolution. She thought she would set this heresy to rest by conducting a sample survey at SIGGRAPH a year ago in Las Vegas. She began her interviews at the airport the minute she stepped off the plane, and by the time she got back to her desk in San Francisco, had talked to 180 important professionals of the computer graphic field, all of whom answered yes to her question, "Do you take psychedelics, and is this important in your work?" So her column in the syndicated in all these newspapers finally said that, and again, unfortunately, or kindly, remembered me. Shortly after this second accident in my story, I was in Hollyhock, the Esalen of the far north, with Rupert and some others of you here. And I had a kind of psychotic break in the night. I couldn't sleep, and I was consumed with a paranoid fantasy about this outage and what it would mean in my future career and the police at my door and so on. And I knew that my fears had kind of blown up unnecessarily, but I needed someone to talk to. The person I knew best there was Rupert, and he was very busy in council with various friends, but eventually I took Rupert aside and I confided to him this secret and all my fears. And his response within a day or two was to repeat the story to everybody in Canada. Well, assuring me that it's good to be outed, and it would be good to come out, and to come out maybe in a best-selling book, which Brockman, our agent, could sell and hawk for a huge royalty advance, and so on. I tried thinking positively about this episode, but when I came home, I still felt nervous about it, and I said no to many interviews from ABC News and the United Nations and other people who called to check out this significant story. I did not rise to the occasion, and so I've decided today, by popular request, to tell the truth. And this is perhaps relevant to our theme for today, different aspects of vision, and our theme this morning of psychedelics and mathematical vision. So it all began in 1967 when I was a professor of mathematics at Princeton, and one of my students turned me on to LSD. That led to my moving to California a year later and my meeting at UC Santa Cruz, a chemistry graduate student who is doing his PhD thesis on the synthesis of DMT. He and I smoked up a large bottle of DMT in 1969, and that resulted in a kind of secret resolve which swerved my career to a search for the connections between mathematics and the experience of the logos, or what Terence calls the transcendent other. This hyperdimensional space full of meaning and wisdom and beauty, which feels more real than ordinary reality, and to which we have returned many times over the years for instruction and pleasure. And in the course of the next 20 years, there were various steps I took to explore this connection between mathematics and the logos. For example, I apprenticed myself to neurophysiologists and tried to construct brain models made out of the basic objects of chaos theory. This was about the time that chaos theory was discovered by the scientific community, and the chaos revolution began in 1973. I built a vibrating fluid machine to visualize vibrations in transparent media, because I felt on the basis of direct experience that the Hindu metaphor of vibrations was an important one, a valuable one, and therefore that we could learn more about consciousness, communication, resonance, and the emergence of form and pattern in the physical, biological, social, and intellectual worlds through actually watching vibrations in transparent media, ordinarily invisible, and making them visible. I was inspired by Hans Jaeny, an amateur scientist in Switzerland, a follower of Rudolf Steiner, who had built an ingenious gadget for rendering these transparent fluids visible. About this time, we discovered in Santa Cruz computer graphics, because the first affordable computer graphic terminals had appeared on the market. I started a project of teaching mathematics with computer graphics, and eventually tried to simulate the mathematical models for neurophysiology and for vibrating fluids in computer programs with computer graphic displays. In this way evolved a new class of mathematical models called CDs, cellular dynamata. They are really especially appropriate mathematical object for modeling or trying to understand the brain, the mind, the visionary experience, and so on, as far, as close anyway as mathematics could come to simulation of this experience. At the same time, other mathematicians, some of whom may have been recipients of my gifts in the 1960s, began their own experiments with computer graphics in different places and began to make films, which I used to show in annual film clairvoyance of this evening later on, in many years later, when I would be sitting in this theater watching a computer graphic film made by Tom Benchoff. You remember that?
Mm-hmm.
Eventually, we were able to construct machines in Santa Cruz which could simulate these kind of mathematical models that I call CDs at a reasonable speed, first slowly and then faster and faster. And in 1989, I had a fantastic experience at the NASA Goddard Space Flight Center in Maryland, where I was given access to, at that time, the fastest supercomputer, the MPP, the Massively Parallel Processor. And my CD model for the visual cortex had been programmed into this machine by the only person able to program it, and I was invited to come and view the result. And looking at the color screen of this supercomputer was like looking through the window at the future and seeing an excellent memory of a DMT vision, not only proceeding apace on the screen, but also going about 100 times faster than a human experience, and also under the control of knobs which I could turn at the terminal. And so, returning to my story now, and I'll quickly bring it to a close, there is, first of all, a 20-year evolution from my DMT year, 1969, to my MPP year, 1989. And following this 20-year evolution and that the recording of that video, we had two things that I'll mention. One is the story with GQ and SIGGRAPH and the Examiner that I've told you, which essentially poses the question, then, has a psychedelic had an influence in the evolution of science, mathematics, the computer revolution, computer graphics, and so on. And the other event, in 1990, we got to see, after, I think, the publication of a paper on this in the International Journal of Bifurcation and Chaos, we saw an interesting article in the monthly notices of the American Mathematical Society, the largest union of research mathematicians in the world, which amazingly redefined mathematics, dropping number and geometrical spaces as relics of history, and adopting a new definition of mathematics as the study of space-time pattern. So this is not written by me. This is just in the pages of Science and the monthly notices of the American Mathematical Society. So we have to admit that mathematics has been reborn, and this rebirth is some kind of outcome of, apparently, of the computer revolution and the psychedelic revolution, which took place concurrently, concomitantly, cooperatively in the 1960s. And I might mention a current event on this horizon, redefining this material as an art medium. I'm going to be able to give a concert of this material played in real time with a genuine supercomputer in October in the Cathedral of St. John the Divine, the largest Gothic cathedral in the world. Well then, let's come to our subject. And I don't know if you gentlemen need to move up a little bit so that we can trialogue. Now I have to do, since I took so much time on a personal odyssey, I have to do to induce trialogue in 1 minute. And so this shortcut, what I want to do is just pose one or two questions and read one or two excerpts from some favorite books here. So we have to accept now, I think, mathematics either in the new definition or the old one. In the Renaissance cosmology of John Dee, mathematics is seen as the joint therapist of Father Sky and Mother Earth, or a kind of an intellectual, spiritual, elastic medium connecting up the heavenly realms and Gaia herself. That puts mathematics then in on the same level as the Logos, the Holy Spirit. So let's just consider that for the sake of discussion. And having seen it as a language of space-time pattern, let me ask you this, Terence and Roop. To what extent could the psychedelic vision of the Logos be externalized? Could it be externalized by any means, either by verbal descriptions, by computer simulations, by drawings of really inspired visionary artists? Or on the other hand, in what ways could possibly mathematical vision serve the spirit and extend the mind? Is there a role, in other words, for this kind of thing in our main concerns? And to give you a fast forward into the answer, let me just read a couple of things here from Fruit of the Gods. And Terence's confessional chapter, chapter 15, a section called Art in the Revolution, he says, "The archaic revival is a clarion call to recover our birthright, however uncomfortable that may make us. It is a call to realize that life lived in the absence of the psychedelic experience upon which primordial shamanism is based is life trivialized, life denied, life enslaved to the ego and its fear of disillusion in the mysterious matrix of feeling that is all around us. It is in the archaic revival that our transcendence of the historical dilemma actually lies. There is something more. It is now clear that new developments in many areas, including mind-machine interfacing, pharmacology of the synthetic variety, and data storage, imaging, and retrieval techniques. It is now clear that new developments in these areas are coalescing into the potential for a truly demonic or an angelic self-imaging of our culture." Do you remember that at all? I don't know if you've tapped into chapter 15, Roop. Here's another one then, in the Rebirth of Nature, the final paragraph of the entire book entitled A New Renaissance. Rupert says, "As soon as we allow ourselves to think of the world as alive, we recognize that a part of us knew this all along. It is like emerging from winter into spring. We can begin to reconnect our mental life with our own direct intuitive experiences of nature. We can participate in the spirits of sacred places and times. We can see that we have much to learn from traditional societies who have never lost their sense of connection with the living world around them. We can acknowledge the animistic traditions of our ancestors, and we can begin to develop a richer understanding of human nature, shaped by tradition and collective memory, linked to the earth and the heavens, related to all forms of life, and consciously open to the creative power expressed in all evolution. We are reborn into a living world." I call down then the trialogue mode. Psychedelics and mathematical vision.
Well, the question that you posed in all of that, the nuts and bolts question, is can it be visualized with technologies ranging from paint and brush to supercomputers? I think it can. I think it is not in principle mysterious that it's a domain to be explored, it may be fleeting, like the situation that follows upon the splitting of the atom or something like that. It may be remote, but it is in principle describable, and it's simply a matter of paying attention, gaining inspiration, and gaining skill of technical execution. I think you think that, don't you?
Well, I think that any models that we can build, verbal, visual, or mathematical, are really, really feeble compared to the experience itself. On the other hand, this experience is within all and without all, and we are immersed in this spiritual world. So the tiniest resonance from the most feeble model may suffice to excite, as poetry excites emotion, to excite spirit. And this is the essence of communication, is to have a compact representation. So the experience is infinitely complex, and the representations have to be really simple. But the verbal representation restricted to verbal mode alone might be too feeble, not similar enough to excite by resonance the similar state. I mean, we have the situation where we agree that not every person is going to become a cephalopod. Not every person has the time to become a shaman. That we need a certain number of shamans in our culture to help to reconnect human society and the planet and the sky. So we need some kind of amplifying and communicating device between the few people who are real shamans, let's say sacred artists of the future, and the mass society watching MTV. And so the question is, can these means be of use to the clarion call that you've given in your book?
Yeah, I mean, I think that what makes it confusing is when you go into these domains, the encounter is an emotionally powerful one, and the situation is so novel that the experience tends to assume that this emotional power is coming from the input. It's not. It's coming from the encounter with the input. I mean, it's like posing the question, can you make a stirring record of the Grand Canyon? Yes, you can, with helicopter-mounted cameras and this sort of thing. But the emotion you have watching that, you bring to it. So the psychedelic dimension is objective, but it's also so awesome and so different from what we know that it encourages and promotes and triggers awe in us. And so we bring something to it which we can never image or reduce to a verbal description or a piece of film. But in principle, I think the thing itself is just more of reality. It's like the heart of the cell, the radar maps of the Venusian surface, the center of the atom. I mean, these are real
things. But this kind of reality, we don't need more of this. We've already got so much.
No, we need more of our of this mental logos world. It's the logos world that we've lost the connection with. And so these computer programs, psychedelic drugs, dynamic modeling schemes are the equivalent of probes like Voyager. But they're sent not to an alien planet, but to an alien phase space of some sort, but one that we need connection to.
I agree with Terence. The problem is one of the emotional intensity of a psychedelic experience is totally different from seeing the computer graphic display of the kind we saw. And it's possible to get something a bit like that just by shaking a kaleidoscope and looking into it. and in these expensive novelty shops that dot California, one can find fancy kaleidoscopes, beautifully made, and people buy them, I suppose, and you look through them, and within a few seconds you're just bored. Nobody ever really looks at them for very long. You can see a dazzling series of displays of pattern and colour, but somehow they have no meaning and don't engage one. And I think the difference between a representation of the state and being in the state itself is this sense of meaning, engagement and intensity. And that, I think, is the problem, because I don't think it's just the graphic representation. I think it's that meaning and intensity that we can find in many areas. I, for one, being a botanist, I'm very drawn to flowers. I love looking at flowers. And sometimes you can look at a whole garden full of flowers, like here in Esalen, and it's quite meaningless. At other times, you can look at a single flower for a long time. You can go into it. It's like a mandala. You enter into this realm. And it takes on incredible meaning, beauty, and significance. And the realm of flowers is one that's explored these mandala-type, almost psychedelic spaces, if you like. And one can sometimes enter into it and sometimes one doesn't. The same with butterflies and many other natural creations. So it seems to me the problem is how to enter into that engagement, intensity, and sense of meaning rather than representation of the pattern itself, because there's plenty of patterns around in the natural world.
No, but these are space-time patterns. And whereas we can say the words space-time pattern, we nevertheless have no language for individual space-time patterns. Within space-time pattern, as experienced by us, as perceived by us, there is a kind of a resonance between different patterns that we see. Let us say the bobbing kelp forests in the ocean out here. That somehow makes different elements of that space-time pattern make a resonance with different space-time patterns of neurotransmitters in the visual cortex or something. So some aspects are perceived and other aspects are not. They remain invisible to us. And yet we don't have any language for what we perceive. So we can't, as Rupert suggested, have data storage and retrieval on this level. We don't have language for that. You've been, say, speaking of the flowers in the garden or the images in the kaleidoscope. These are static patterns. We have an extensive verbal language for that. So what I'm suggesting is an expansion of our visual linguistic capability in the direction of a universal language for space-time patterns, such that we could then speak of our experience. We could remember space-time pattern experiences, call them by name. We could mention to each other the mere drop of a word or a code, an I-75, a Highway 1, a Highway 0, and then we would be transmitting a huge image of a space-time pattern along with whatever emotion you remember from the time when you experienced that. Awakening this in the mind of the listener and therefore able to converse, intellectualize, understand, and reconnect with the space-time pattern of and feeling of the spiritual world. I mean, let's face it, we have had the most extensive experience of this world through visual metaphors of, well, movies. We experience the logos as movies. We don't experience this at words, although there are sounds and there are words pop up from, and sometimes there's writing on the wall like graffiti. Basically, it's an infinite field of consciousness, of vibration, of waves moving, of intelligence which may be disconnected in different parts. And when we travel in this realm, we go somewhere we've been before and we recognize it, and that excites in us memory, which is reinforced, which is extended, upon which we can do further experiment because we do remember that somehow our mental faculty, individually and within, it has data storage and retrieval and it has a language or something, and yet we can't share it. Even let us just say us three, we've had our many experiences which I trust, I have great faith, are similar, that are universal experience, and yet we are absolutely speechless in verbalizing them to each other so we could see whether we had or didn't have any similarity in this certain, I'm sorry, words fail me.
Well, I don't know. It seems to me that art or that mind responds, it has an affinity for itself. And if it's universal, then it has an affinity for the universal mind. What's interesting about the example of the kaleidoscope is it's boring after a few minutes. We all agree on that. If you analyze how it works and take it apart, the base units in most kaleidoscopes are pieces of broken glass, pebbles, things like this. Detritus, junk, and somehow splitting this into six sections with a mirror and putting it in heavy oil is supposed to bring you to the realm of something watchable and interesting, but it isn't. The brain machines being produced in Germany are the same way. All pattern seems to be to quickly lose its charm unless it's pattern that has been put through the sieve of minds, any mind, so that when we enjoy looking at ruins and the artifacts of vanished civilizations a lot more than random arrangements of natural objects. So it seems to me what we're looking for when we say it's like a DMT trip, the MPPI data on chaos, then what we're saying is, aha, here in this pattern there is the footstep of the footprint of meaning. It's as though an architect passed through here, and so we can appreciate it. So we're always looking for the betraying presence of an order that is more than an order of, I don't know even how to say it, economy, I guess. We look for an aesthetic order, and when we find that, then we have this reciprocal sense of recognition and transcendence, and this is what the psychedelic experience provides in spades. Now, a critic of the psychedelic experience would object, of course it's made of mind. It's made of your mind. But for the psychedelic voyager, this does not seem to be obvious. The intuition is it is made of mind, but it is not made of my mind. So then either there's an identity problem or a real frontier of communication is being crossed. But I think when we say we look for living pattern or aesthetically satisfying order, what we really mean is we look for the sign that mind has somehow touched the stochastic processes of nature.
Yes, but still the limiting factor seems to be neither the richness of display we find in nature, nor even the language that we can communicate with, but rather the ability to go into something with intensity of vision. Because I don't think language is a limiting problem. I mean, for example, music can be written down in a language. You can get a score of Beethoven's symphonies or Mozart piano concertos. I mean, I can read music, but for me, it doesn't come to life from this language. I have to hear it for it to come to life. The language is indeed a kind of communication, but it has to come to life. Presumably, mathematical notation is a form of notating things in the mathematical landscape which mathematicians can see. And take the realm of plants again. If you look at the incredible richness of botany, of flower forms, this is all, there is a language for this. It's used by botanists and florists. You've got books, you know, about the, there are words for these different kinds of flowers. And for a botanist, the whole thing can be written down in the specialized language. But even so, it doesn't mean that most botanists spend most of their time contemplating the beauty of flowers. They're sort of rushing to the next committee meeting or getting their paper ready for the next public journal or something. That somehow there isn't much time spent in actually entering into these realms, even for people whose profession it is to be concerned with them. So we're neither short of images, nor of languages in many realms, but rather of the time, the space, and the inclination to enter into these realms, to be within them.
Well, this is a good metaphor, I think, the musical metaphor. Let's just think of this for a minute. I don't propose that a mathematical model of a brain or a plant or something would be as wonderful as a brain or a plant. Life will not be replaced by language. We never demand that much of ordinary language or poetry or of the graphic arts. Nevertheless, the evolution of music has been greatly aided by musical notation. Of course, we wouldn't like music to end and simply be left with a library of musical scores. Nevertheless, the evolution of music, the evolution of culture, has been enormously facilitated by having a graphic language that can, to some extent, recall the actual musical experience. And this is the role that I'm proposing for mathematics, not to replace the earth or the heavenly realms, but just somehow to facilitate the traffic through, let us say, simply an analog on the same level of musical staff notation that pertains to the visual experience of space-time patterns, whether of a flowering garden or the waving sea or the psychedelic vision.